Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is podcast number 90. This is January 27th, 2012. Happy Friday, folks. As I have been doing, I wanted to begin the podcast by reading once again. I'm going to bore you if you're a regular listener, but I want to emphasize the importance of this because there's a lot of confusion right now among libertarians, and I really want to emphasize this. So once again, I'm going to read this definition by L. Neil Smith. A libertarian is a person who believes that no one has the right, under any circumstances, to initiate force against another human being or to advocate or delegate its initiation. Those who act consistently with this principle are libertarians, whether they realize it or not. Those who fail to act consistently with it are not libertarians, regardless of what they may claim. L. Neil Smith. And once again, as I regularly say, that does not exclude self-defense. Self-defense is perfectly acceptable in the zero aggression principle or the non-aggression principle, which is what we're talking about here. I want to do a real quick recap of the first part of this series. In it, I talked about local police as a temporary transition to a police state. We start off with local police. We start off, first off, the state, and I talked about London and the creation of the original bobbies and the original local police. The state created the situation where the state created a nurturing environment for crime. And then the state offered a solution to the crime, and that was local police. But the problem with this is that I talked about there being these flaws built into the system that guaranteed that the moment that we accept the possibility of local police, we guarantee that at some point in time, we will have a police state. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. I talked about some of the steps last time, and I talked about some of the transition and the drug war and things like this. But I also talked about the two personalities, the two types that are drawn toward being police. And I used the Andy, the Sheriff Andy and the Deputy Barney example from the old TV show from the 60s. Now, and as I said before, Sheriff Andy was a wise man. He was a good man. He was very clever. He was a peaceable man. And he was able to do his job, do it well, and do it in a nonviolent form. But when it was necessary, he would get as violent as he needed to in order to do his job. Now, the idea of being a police officer on any level, we're talking about from the lowest, the smallest little towns where you're, you know, most of your job is just, small town stuff, all the way up to the highest levels in government where you're acting in a law enforcement capacity. The same rule stands. There's basically two motivations to get involved. Like Sheriff Andy, the person wants to make a difference in the community. They want to do the right thing. And they have within them the desire to serve their community. But you also have some who are the Barneys. Now, as I said last week, you take away the comic tendencies, the cartoonish part that they had to put on for television in order to the comedy relief in order to make it funny and make it entertaining. You take all that away, and what you have is a very nasty little man. You have a guy who just wants nothing but attention. He wants authority. He wants the ability to push people around and not face the consequences for his action. Now, at first in this process, very few Barneys, now we're going to call Barney the B, okay, rather than keep referring to Barney all the time. He's going to be the type B, and we're going to refer to the Andy, Sheriff Andy, as the type A. So Andy A, Barney B, nice and easy to remember. When this system first starts out, it's far more likely than you're going to get a lot more Andys, A's, than you are B's. But the problem is, because of the flaws I'm going to talk about in a minute, the process itself will weed out the A's and prefer the B's. And this system will continue until there are more B's in positions of power than there are A's. And eventually, when that takes place, when the scale is tipped and those in the higher level of authority are more B's in power than A's, then you begin on the path towards the dominance of the B's and the loss of the A's as an influence. And that's the direction that it is inevitably going to head. Now, we'll talk about that in a minute when we get into the economics of this. We may have to break off for a second with dog barking. Okay, so I'll just try to work through that. And now, in the earlier episode, I talked about the war on drugs and the progression and the escalation of violence that takes place by the very fact that there is a war on drugs. The fact that the government decides to crack down on drugs creates a situation where the drug trade becomes more profitable, it becomes more lucrative to those who are in it, it becomes more violent. The police respond to that by having to arm themselves heavier in order to be safe as they're doing their job. That results in higher levels of violence among the crime people that are controlling the drug trade. This escalates the violence even further, causing the police to militarize even more, which causes the violent drug cartels to militarize even more, which causes the police to militarize even more. And this constant ratcheting takes place and just drives the system to create more and more of a police state, all because some busybodies are upset that somebody somewhere may grow a plant or do something with that plant that they can't tolerate. Or, more likely, some politician decides to use that fear of the busybody to get himself into a more powerful position in government. Oh, and in the earlier episode, I referred to a story in the Washington Post. Now, I had intended to read from it and let you see some of the exaggerations and just constant lies of where this Washington Post article, the article itself is basically stating that the local representatives of local police from all over the United States have gone to Washington and to be a part of this combating homegrown terrorism. And then the story just repeats that phrase, homegrown terrorism, over and over and over throughout the two-page article. And it just hypes it and hypes it and hypes it up. I mean, even if you buy this story, which I don't, that we're under constant threat of these homegrown terrorists, well, you know, it's getting to the point where they're just basically anybody who they want to be a homegrown terrorist is a homegrown terrorist. Okay, so let's get away from the bias reporting of the Washington Post. I mentioned that there were three things, two major things, and then one side issue that drive this process, and that once we accept the idea of having police, and again, now, this is not to say, the last time I used the example of London, and London existed something like 1750 years or something like that, that London was a city populated by people who did not just fall upon each other and destroy each other, but it lasted that long without the need for police. But it was the state that created that need for the police. And then the state fulfilled that need. So what I'm talking about when I say that to accept the police is the beginning of the problem, that's not to say that we don't need some type of law and order, or we don't need the processes of protection and these kind of things. I'm not saying that. I'm saying you can have those things without police. Police didn't exist until about 1800. And yet the world was not filled with complete lawlessness, and you couldn't, there were cities all around the world where you could walk around and be totally safe long before there were police. So you have to separate it out in your mind and realize that we don't have to have police to have law enforcement and respect of one another's rights and these things. Police are entirely an invention of the state in and around the year 1800. Prior to that, we didn't need them. And in a lot of places, even in the United States, for years and years after that, we didn't need police. And again, that doesn't mean we have total lawlessness. One thing is not connected to the other in the sense that most people think it is. It is connected in this way. The more police you have, the more lawlessness you have. And just to throw out this concept, the very act of having a person who is a police officer, you have this costumed individual with the badge, and he has authority that nobody else has. So I used the example last time. You have two men walking down the street. Each of them has a piece of wood in his hand. Each of them sees someone doing something they don't approve of. Each of them whacks that person with the wood. Now, one of these people is bad and they're a criminal because they're not in a costume and they don't have a badge, but the other one is a hero because he's in a costume and he has a badge, and in the very fact that he works for the state, and now I'm not talking about like the state of Kansas, I'm talking about the state with a capital S, that dragon I was referring to earlier. Because he works for the state, his actions are acceptable. But if he's not employed by the state, his actions are not acceptable. The mall cop is not going to get away with the kind of violence that the cop in that New Hampshire high school cafeteria got away with. You're not going to see that happen with a mall cop. And the reason why is because he's employed by the mall. He's not employed by the state. And this is the key. The state authorizes people to do things that they would never normally do. But they can get away with doing those things because there are no repercussions for your actions when you're an employee of the state. Okay, now, but that's not the economic thing I was going to refer to. We have two principles of economics that I want to talk about. The first one is self-selection bias. Now, self-selection bias, let me take a real quick look here at Wikipedia. Self-selection bias. Okay, they're looking more at the statistical end of it, which we can twist that into our needs here, but I'll read what Wikipedia has to say on self-selection bias. In statistics, self-selection bias arises in any situation in which individuals select themselves into a group, causing a biased sample with non-probability sampling. It is commonly used to describe situations where the characteristics of the people which cause them to select themselves in the group create abnormal or undesirable conditions in the group. Well, that's not bad. That's not exactly the intent that I had for it, but we can extract my intent out of that. Now, I would give the example of self-selection bias of, well, we're talking about statistics, so let's go in that direction. You always hear about these phone surveys, or sometimes they don't tell you that it's a phone survey, but people like CNN or, you know, all the different organizations that do these surveys, most of them are done by phone, and they will ask some series of questions in a phone survey. And on occasion, if the people publishing the survey are honest, which is not always the case, they will give you the exact questions that they're asking in the survey. Now, they don't always give you all the questions. Now, I know this because I worked in that industry for a while. What they'll do when they call is they identify themselves as the organization that's doing the survey, and they ask what are called qualifying questions. Are you the head of the household? Are you male? Are you female? Are you, can I ask your education level? Would you say your income is between 20 and 30,000, 30 and 40,000, 40 and 50,000? So they ask all these qualifying questions first so that they get the subgroup of people they're looking for to get the kind of answer they're looking for in most cases. But even if they don't do that, even if it's an honest survey, and some people in the survey industry are chomping at the bit right now if they heard me say that, because they're going to argue that those qualifying questions are still part of an honest survey. I know enough about the industry. Anyway, back to the point. Even if it is an honest survey, there is still an aspect of self-selection bias which destroys the possibility of any phone survey being accurate. Now, here's a couple reasons why. First off, what time of the day are they doing the phone survey? What's the likelihood of what kind of people are going to be answering the phone at that time of the day? Of those people answering the phone, what type of people are most likely to see what group of that people are more likely to have a caller ID and choose not to answer the phone because they see a number that they don't recognize? And then what proportion of the population is either going to answer that number knowing that this is a number they don't recognize, or they don't have caller ID and they decide to answer the phone? So as this all goes through, it becomes more and more likely that you're going to talk to a 14-year-old kid who will lie to you and tell you they're 22, or you're talking to a 70-year-old who is far more likely to talk to a stranger who calls them than, say, someone like me, who, if I see a strange number pop up on my caller ID, I just don't answer it. Or if I am in a particularly nasty mood, and I recognize it either as a telemarketer or as a survey person, I might, just because I'm not a nice person, I might answer them just to give them a hard time. Especially when I'm in the right kind of a mood, I like to catch a good telemarketer and really, that's beside the point. Anyway, but there is a self-selection bias here in my example with, let's just say, old, lonely people taking far more phone surveys than, say, paranoid libertarians do. The phone survey is far more likely to get a 14-year-old who lies and says they're 30, or an old person who's lonely and will answer any question any way you guide them to answer it, just so that they can talk to you on the phone. Those are far more likely than to, say, get a hold of a 50, 55-year-old radical libertarian and have that person express their opinion. So, in other words, we don't know how many 50 to 55-year-old radical libertarians there are, because generally they don't take phone surveys. So this is a self-selection bias within the phone survey organization that causes all phone surveys to be twisted in particular directions, even if there's every attempt to make the phone survey as honest as possible. Now, a different example of this, going back by not so much a survey, but like a scientific study, can get twisted like this really quick if the researchers are not really careful. And you see this kind of thing in the media all the time. They'll say something like you'll see a headline that says something like, "Study reveals smokers more likely to visit bars." Or, you know, some ridiculous statement like that. Now, according to how they biased their survey to begin with, but again, let's just assume that somebody did a legitimate or attempted to do a legitimate study on this, and they try to make some kind of correlation, some kind of cause and effect between people who are smokers and people who visit bars. But the problem is, there are so many societal and so many individual variations in this that are going to throw that off. For example, if the bars that they're examining allow smoking, then by far smokers are going to have a greater tendency to visit that bar than non-smokers. So of course you're going to get a biased sample. Most of the people in the bar will have a greater tendency to smoke if smoking is allowed in the bar. But if you go and find a non-smoking bar and do the same survey, you're going to have drastically different results. And the reason why is because there's a self-selection bias as to smokers who go to bars that allow smoking. So, now how are we going to take this to twist this around to the police? Well, this is what I was talking about with Andy and Barney, with the A and B individuals. There is a natural bias in police work in the A classification, in the Andy classification, there's a natural bias in police work to draw in certain personalities who want to help the community, who want to do good and want to do these things and want to do right. And there's also a natural tendency among some people who have the B personality, the Barney personality, who just want to wear the uniform all the time, everywhere they go. They want to be the big shot. They want to lord over people. They want to dominate people as much as possible. They want recognition. They want authority. And yes, there are some of those people who... Okay, so Nikki is awake. Nikki is awake. Anyway, I'll try to pick back up. There are some of those people in the B category who actually have mental problems, and they want to hurt people, and this is a good excuse. This is a way they can get paid to do it. There is also a problem with police work. Your typical on-the-beat police work, where a guy is sitting in a car for hours at a time in total boredom, and the total boredom of the job is interrupted by moments of extreme tension where he's walking up to a stranger's car, and he has to be at full alert because he doesn't know if he's walking up to the car of someone who just happened to forget to turn on their turn signal, and they're on their way to the ladies' auxiliary and they're perfectly harmless, or it's a gang member who is whacked out on some kind of drug and extremely dangerous and in a bad mood and just broke up with his girlfriend and has a gun sitting on his lap. The cop doesn't know that one way or the other. So when he pulls over someone or she pulls over someone, they've gone through hours of unbelievable boredom in their job, punctuated by these moments of extreme stress. And so that aspect of the job drives some personalities towards the job and some personalities away from the job. And this is all part of the self-selection bias that I was talking about. Now, a lot of the A-type people are going to be turned off by that aspect of police work. But some B-type people are going to really going to pull their triggers for them. They're really going to like that adrenaline rush that where they walk up not knowing if they're going to face, exactly what it's going to. There's, you know, adrenaline is a thing. Even to a certain extent, the fear and the anticipation that come with something like that, it's a real driving factor for some people. Now, okay, so that's self-selection bias. Now, the reason that this is a problem with the B personality is that the state itself has a flaw built within it. And I've talked about this on several occasions. And I'm not going to go, we just simply don't have time today to go into a whole thing on examining how it is that this is a characteristic of the state. But this is, I've done that before on several other podcasts. But this is a characteristic of the state. The state has an appeal to people who want to become an employee of the state because they can work for the state, and the state gives them the opportunity to act with the authority of the state and therefore without being individually responsible for their actions. And that's one of the things that the state does. This is a two-sided thing. People within the state are rewarded for their actions, no matter whether they're typically acceptable among people or not, because the state takes the heat for them. People forgive the actions of an individual who's employed by the state because he's employed by the state. He's just doing his job. And then the other aspect of that is if you're outside of the state, and I talked before about the snoopy neighbor who doesn't want to approach their neighbor and say, hey, you know, that bush is really ugly and it makes our whole neighborhood look bad. So they would rather call the city and rat you out than come up and, you know, ask if they could help you maybe trim that bush or whatever. So the state gives them the opportunity to act without consequences. And that's one of the main things, one of the main appeals, if not the main appeal of the state, is it allows people to act without the consequences of their actions. And so that's an aspect that really appeals to the B and does not appeal to the A person. You see? So it creates a bias there. Now there's already a bias to draw in both the A and the B person. But now we have a bias that draws the B greater than the A. So again, as I said earlier, when we very first accept the state, and through the early phases of this, there's a greater appeal to the A personality than the B, because there's this desire to do good. But as the process continues, and we'll get into that in a minute, the A person is weeded out, and there becomes less and less motivation for new A people to come in. Yet the B person is rewarded by, within the system, the B person is rewarded more and more with upgrades in their pay, with greater levels of responsibility, until they begin to take over the government entity that is police work. The B people begin to take over. And this is something that's called regulatory capture. And any economists that are hearing me right now that they may be saying, well, that's not really what regulatory capture is. Well, yeah, it is. Stick with me and I'll show you. Okay. But before I get into regulatory capture, I want to first relate this to one other thing about the state. Remember, corporations exist only because the state allows them to exist. Without the state, there would be no corporations. Corporation is a legal definition by the state. And when a company gets to the size of where they become a corporation and they begin to utilize the monopolization that the state allows them. Now, that's not to say all corporations are evil. That is to say that when corporations begin to utilize the state, which is their natural tendency, then a symbiotic relationship begins to take place between the state and the corporation. But this corporation can never exist without the state. Now, that's, to some economists, that's going to be a radical statement, but let me point this out to you. The corporation has the same flaw that I'm describing with the police and the same flaw that I'm describing with the state itself. The corporation has no mechanism built within it to reward or punish individual behavior. And you're going to say, well, somebody can get fired. Well, here's the difference, and I've talked about this before with private companies and with corporations. Here's a quick scenario, and I'm sure if you're a regular listener, you've heard this before, so I'll be as brief as possible. And for newer listeners, I'll say, go back and listen to my older stuff. Anyway, there's just too much to cover in one podcast here. Okay, so a private company. A guy, Bob. Bob decides he's going to apply for a job at Bill's machine shop. So Bob goes down to Bill's machine shop and he puts in an application. Bill runs the machine shop. It's privately owned. He's got 200 workers maybe, but it's his machine shop. So maybe there's one or two people that screen the applicants first. Maybe there's not. But one way or the other, now I got confused because they were both... One was Bob and one was Bill, and I don't know which was which. So let's take totally opposite. Let's not worry about names. We'll go with the applicant, and we'll go with the business owner. I got to stop doing these podcasts without a cup of coffee sitting here. So the applicant puts in his application, and the owner of the machine shop reviews it and says, well, you know, I do have a spot open for someone to sweep the floor. Will you take that job? Well, that's not the job the applicant wanted, but okay, it's better some work than no work. So he takes the job. Now, after a couple weeks, the owner of the machine shop is watching him, and he realizes, well, he's got pretty good work ethics. He's, you know, maybe we'll try him out on one of those more simple machines and see how he does. And so the owner of that business, the private owner, can watch firsthand. And if he sees someone with potential, he can bring them up through the ranks and find a position that best matches their capabilities. On the other hand, he might see that person and he might realize, you know, that guy is working at his limit when he's just pushing the broom around. So let's just keep him right where he's at, or let's get rid of him or whatever. But the private owner of the business is seeing this firsthand, and he has a major motivation to weed out the bad and to draw in the good. And he has a direct motivation to pay the good workers whatever it takes to keep them in there so long as they're profitable to him. Now, let's say he hires a guy who's really a go-getter, And this guy is really on the ball, and all those other words like that that we could use to describe this guy. He really is bright. And so the machine shop owner hires him, brings him in. The guy learns several different machines. His leadership ability is obvious. The owner puts him in charge of a group of other workers, goes ahead and gives him a higher pay rate, continues rewarding him, continues increasing his trust in the individual. The private business owner can never be threatened by this guy, no matter how good he is, because the business owner owns the business. The guy can never work his way up through the ranks and replace the business owner, because the business owner owns the business. Now, in a sense, you could say, well, if he gets good enough, he could buy the business. And that's actually a motivation to a business owner. Hey, one day if I get the guy with the right capabilities and I get old enough, maybe I can sell this thing and retire off of it and let somebody else take the business. So all the way through, at all levels, the private business owner has a motivation to bring in the best and the brightest, and to reward them and bring them up through the system and improve his company. The corporation has no such motivation. If you work in a corporation, you are just a face. You're just a number. You're just a name written on a scroll. That's all you are. And if you show potential, you're going to do two things. First off, you're going to irritate your coworkers, because they all have a motivation to keep you down to their level, which is the lowest level that they can get away with working at. That motivation is built within the corporate structure. But in the eyes of the manager or the eyes of the supervisor, or whatever level of supervision that we're talking about, they want someone who is willing to do the work, and maybe even part of their work. A manager loves to have an underling who's willing to do some of his work for him. But the manager, in most cases, does not want somebody who's a real go-getter, a real bright up-and-coming type, because he realizes that that guy might replace him. If his boss finds out how good that guy is, his position's not safe. He could actually end up working for that guy. And when you take that concept and you multiply it out over all the levels of the corporation, the longer the corporation exists and the bigger the corporation gets, the more incompetent it becomes. Now, so how does a corporation continue to get big if this flaw is built into it? Look at the biggest corporations in the world, and you will find that all of the biggest corporations in the world are entirely dependent upon government monopolies. They are defense contractors. They are agribusiness. They are the banking, the huge banking industries, and the huge finance industries. The largest companies, the most powerful corporations in the world, depend entirely upon the state. The smaller, more independent ones are pretty much subject to those larger ones. But on a level playing field with no state involved, there's no way the corporate structure can ever produce anything as efficient as the private business. Therefore, without the state, there would be no corporate structure. Private business would destroy them in competition. Additionally, that's just on the labor end of it. If you take the same concept and put it over to the sales end, to satisfying the customer's needs, the private business has every desire and every motivation to satisfy the individual customer's needs. But the bigger the corporation gets, it only really needs to satisfy the government. That's all it really needs to worry about. If it can continue its government contracts, it can dominate its lower, smaller competition. The same thing goes in every aspect. See, the same flaw is built in. It's actually an aspect of central planning and of socialism. And this is what is a flaw in the state, because the state's designed the same way. The same exact mechanism drives the best in politics, the best as far as the most corrupt, the most likely to do those nasty things that we don't want politicians to do. The most efficient politicians are the Barney-type politicians, and they're driven to the top of the state structure, where the A's, the, if you might want to say it, well, you know, we're talking about the Sheriff Andys, but compare Sheriff Andy to Ron Paul. I realize he's very popular right now, but that's an anomaly. That's not normal. That's an oddity. Ron Paul is very much the exception to all these rules. But, well, time will tell, and you'll see that I'm, if you listen to the rest of what I've said about Ron Paul, you're going to see that I'm right about him. He has no chance whatsoever of ever becoming president, at least not alive, because those people who control all of this stuff won't let him get there. But anyway, in the same way with Sheriff Andy, you're not going to see Sheriff Andy in charge of the FBI. Okay, so where was I going with that? Well, let's get to regulatory capture before I completely run out of time. Let me get back to Wikipedia and get to regulatory capture on Wikipedia. Oh, Wikipedia has a big article on regulatory capture. Okay, let's read the intro and see how this does. In economics, regulatory capture occurs when a state regulatory agency created to act in the public interest instead advances the commercial or special interests that dominate the industry or sector it is charged with regulating. Regulatory capture is a form of government failure, as it can act as an encouragement for large firms to produce negative externalities. The agencies are called captured agencies. That's excellent. That's beautiful right there. Okay, so let me take a quick glance at my notes here. My notes tell me to read the ICC section of this definition, so I'm going to scroll down and read the ICC section. Okay, historians, political scientists, and economists have used the Interstate Commerce Commission, a now defunct federal regulatory body in the United States, as a classic example of regulatory capture. Okay, rather than me reading this, let me just tell you basically what went on. Back in the Grover Cleveland administration, there was a lot of, there was this Interstate Commerce Commission, and they were set up to sort, because people were afraid of the power that the railroads had. The big railroads were becoming, yeah, they were an arm of the state, and the state was basically just handing them money, contracts, and free land, and they were becoming very aggressive, very nasty corporations. And so in the Grover Cleveland administration, there was this drive among the powerful railroad companies to kill the Interstate Commerce Commission. And this Grover Cleveland's attorney general essentially went before the big shots in the railroad industry and said, look, you don't want to kill this agency. What you want to do is have somebody like me in charge of this agency so that we can control this agency, and it'll fool everybody into thinking it's doing something to control the railroads, when in fact you guys will actually be in control of the agency. Now that's a real paraphrasing of the situation. But that's why this is the classic example. The Interstate Commerce Commission was eventually, thrown away. And once it was once people saw how corrupt it was gotten rid of. But this model, is the classic example of how this works between, a corporation or a segment of the market that is involved, with the state like that in self-regulating. And the state sets up some kind of commission or some kind of department to regulate that aspect of industry. And the corporations capture that part of the government control of that industry. A perfect example would be what happened with the Federal Reserve just prior to the last housing bubble that popped back in the 2007-2008 when Timothy Geithner was a president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and was literally firsthand among the Wall Street types who created and then popped the big so-called housing bubble. And then lo and behold, the new president comes in, and guess what? Timothy Geithner is in charge of the Federal Reserve. He went to the Treasury. Ben Bernanke went to the Federal Reserve. And Timothy Geithner, who had previously been the New York Fed's, the president of the Federal Reserve of New York, and he becomes Treasury Secretary. Oh, wow. Another classic example of this is Monsanto. Monsanto has completely dominated the market to the point of where they practically don't even rely on studies anymore to get weird things authorized through the government, approved by the FDA, without going through all the hoops that other companies go through. Or when the hoops are gone through, the data is just ignored. And how is it that they do that? Well, it's because the FDA is packed full of Monsanto, former and current and people with connections to Monsanto, and goes right up through both the current and the previous administration. It's because there's a motivation within that sector to get in and control the regulatory agency that controls that sector. So, for instance, if I wanted to sell banana peels and somebody wanted to regulate the sales of banana peels, the best thing I could do is get my person inside the agency that regulates banana peels. See? It's not difficult. Now, how does that work with cops? Well, it's easy enough. Let's first look at this situation on because we have both police on a local level and on a national level. So let's look at real quick at regulatory capture on the local level. Let's say a holiday is coming up, and so the chief of police. Now the chief of police always wants a bigger budget. How often does a chief of police go to the city council and say, "You know what, you guys, you're just so nice, you give us so much money. Why don't you go ahead and cut my budget by 20% and let's go ahead and lay off 10% of my workforce. And, you know, we don't need all these brand new police cars." That's not a very likely scenario, not only for a chief of police, but for any government person who has that kind of a position. They're not going to, the vast majority of them, possibly there's some A's out there, there's some Andes, but the vast majority of them, eventually, when this process goes for enough years, the A's are pushed out, the B's take over, and the B's are not going to ask to have their budget cut. Okay, so the police chief goes to the city council or to the mayor or whatever and says, "You know, we got this holiday coming up. Why don't we, if you just give me some overtime money for my crew, why don't we set up a DUI checkpoint and we'll make things safer? And you know what? You'll be able to go to the voters and say, 'We took so many drunk drivers off the highway last year.' You'll be able to do that and get yourself reelected." And so there's this appeal, see? Capture is taking place. And so there's this appeal. And so the city council says, "You know, that'd be a good idea. We need to get drunk drivers off the road." So the budget is increased and the police set up a DUI checkpoint. And they don't necessarily catch any drunk drivers, but you know what they do? What they do is they catch a lot of seatbelt violations. Now, the nice thing about seatbelt violations is that most people are not going to fight the ticket. You're gonna write the ticket out. They're gonna get the notice in the mail. They're just gonna send a check in. It's no court time. It's very little handling costs in dealing with this. And it's a relatively small fine, so it just slides right through and it goes straight into the city council's pocket, which is a great motivation to have another DUI checkpoint. And so the more this process goes, it's like a self-feeding loop. And it's not just DUI checkpoints. Let's think about this for a minute. Last August, in Philadelphia, a similar process was taking place with the police. And it culminated in a situation where the police were slowly pressuring the city council to enforce nighttime curfews on teenagers. And the more they would get more funding to enforce this curfew, the bigger the problem was with teenagers breaking the curfew. Now, why do you think that is? Because more cops were out looking for the teenagers that were breaking the curfew. It's not because there were more teenagers... are not going to, you can't keep, how are you going to keep teenagers off the street? First off, why would you want to? No, don't give me excuses about crime and gangs and all that. Why do you want to punish a whole segment of the population just because they're too young? But above and beyond all that, that's a whole different rant. So the city of Philadelphia ended up, when this all came to a head last August, the cops literally pulled up in front of movie theaters and waited until the kids would come out from the late movie theater, and before they could walk from the door of the theater to their parents' cars who were waiting for them, the cops would pick them up for curfew violations, even though the parents were right there to pick them up. And they still, in one night, they picked up 50 kids whose parents were right there waiting to pick them up. And then the abuse is obvious. Then the regulatory capture is obvious. And then there's an outcry and we got to do something about it. However, I'm going to run out of time and I'm not even going to get to the rest of this. Well, how do you do? Okay, let me just touch one other thing before I let you off the hook on this one, and we'll pick it up on the next one. The police did a similar thing on a nationwide level, pushing for confiscation laws. And when I get back to this in the next episode, that's what we're going to show. We're going to go for confiscation laws, and I'm going to show you how that eventually using this regulatory capture, confiscation laws were put into place. And this feeds this perpetual loop, just like what I talked about there with DUI checkpoints, and just like I talked about with the curfew, the confiscation laws did the same thing. And so we will have to stretch this out and make it a third one. There's a Bill Anderson interview with Lou Rockwell that's probably a week or two old. And he talks about how this goes into prosecution, how prosecutors tend to be swallowed into this same loop. And I'm going to go into that as well. So be sure and catch the next episode on this. And we will get into how confiscation laws and how that increases this whole process, and how it works with prosecutors, and how innocent people are put into a position where it's better to accept a plea bargain than attempt to fight something, because this thing has grown so out of control, and prosecutors have grown so powerful that they've overrun the entire jury system. And we'll get into that, and we'll get into jury nullification, and we'll get into the same process that takes place with judges. And that's how, this is not just a, when I'm talking about a police state, I'm not just talking about the actual policeman. It takes far more than that. It takes far more than an army of Barneys to make this happen. It takes the entire beast, the entire dragon. And we're going to get into it on the next episode of what are we going to call this? It's not cop bashing. It's really not cop bashing. This is, once you accept the police state is inevitable. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go over to badquaker.com. Thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate it.